You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, February 9th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So we are going to do a little bit of COVID update at the beginning of the show. We don't do this every week anymore, but there was just too much going on I had to talk about. So the big thing is the World Health Organization, the WHO, has released the preliminary results of their investigation in Wuhan, China, of the origins of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And their conclusion is, we don't know. That's basically
inconclusive.
It's right. So their answer is, it's inconclusive.
Well, how much help did they get from China?
That's a good question.
And, it's a fair question.
And it's not clear. That is not clear. Let me just say that. But they said that they do not think there is any evidence that this was released from the lab in Wuhan. And they're not going to pursue it anymore. That they think that's a dead end.
The lab angle.
Yeah, the lab angle.
That's fine. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So which they're looking at places like the wet markets and these sorts of other
Well, they're broadening their possibilities. So there's a couple of things. So in terms of the lab, though, remember that a year ago at the beginning, that was basically just a conspiracy theory. And then based upon evaluation of the virus itself, it was concluded that it does not have the hallmarks of a lab-created virus. Then it kind of just became fringe conspiracy theory for a while. But in the last couple of months, it's come back, not as it's a lab-created virus, but that the Wuhan Virology Lab was researching coronavirus, and it was accidentally released. That is now an alternative lab-derived theory, and that's the one that the World Health Organization was investigating, and they said, no, it doesn't fit the pattern of release and the epidemiology, et cetera. In fact, they also said that the virus does not, that the pattern of release of like the earliest cases does not fit it coming from the wet market because it was already spreading in Wuhan when the first cases were identified in the wet market. So that may not have been the point of origin, although it may have spread through that. They're also not ruling out foreign to China origins of the virus. There were early cases in Europe, and one of the hypotheses that they're going to be investigating is whether or not it was spread through frozen meat.
Right. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
And we've seen that there are multiple animals that can be reservoirs, right? Like mink, like pangolin. So, you know, the fact that certain animals can carry it means that there are a lot of potential sources for the spillover.
So the bat zoonosis, though, that the fact that it came from bats is gaining a lot of strength. And I think that's still the number one hypothesis.
It does suck. In fact, poor bats. They get
separate,
such a bad rap.
A separate study published in Nature Communications, so not the World Health Organization, a separate scientist, have found that SARS-CoV-2 virus is widespread in bat populations in Southeast Asia. It is a massive reservoir of the SARS-CoV-2. So it's still likely that that may be where it came from, but they think that what they don't know is whether it came directly from bats or it passed through another animal. And that's where things like cats or pangolins, you know, come in.
Mm-hmm.
But that hasn't
been
proven.
In other words, these other animals eat the bats and they get bit.
Yeah, just that the virus passed through them and got modified. And then, so interesting, you know, but it was. I was going to do it as a full news item, but the info was so thin. It was just a very preliminary discussion. It wasn't really much meat to talk about, but that's it. I just gave it the summary. So we'll be tracking this. It's still an open question. Obviously, you know, doesn't make any difference for the pandemic right now, but the idea is we need to know where these viruses are getting into the human population so we can prevent or anticipate the next one or minimize the probability or whatever.
Definitely.
But isn't that a huge variable, Steve? I mean, are bats more likely than other mammals or other animals?
Well, for this virus, right? Other viruses may have other reservoirs, you know, whether it's pigs or birds or whatever, that are more important. But for this one, it was definitely the bat. So, you know, the virus is still spreading massively. The new variants really are having an impact. In Denmark, the UK variant is doubling daily. In the U.S., it's just starting to spread, but it's still, it's like the number of cases with that variant like doubles every day. And so, you know, that how that geometric curve works. So the experts are predicting that by like the end of March, we're going to get another surge based on the new variant, you know, of the virus. And we're essentially in a race against time between the vaccine and these new variants, these new more contagious variants. So
it's like a humidifier and dehumidifier battling it out.
Is that right?
Right.
Is really that your take on it, Bob?
That's the best metaphor you can put up.
Battle box.
Perfect.
It's It's that we just got to get this virus. We got to get this vaccine in as many arms as possible before we get another pulse, another surge from these new variants. And it's not just the UK variant. Obviously, there's the Brazil variant and the South African variant, which actually may be more deadly, not just more contagious.
Yeah, and also the South African variant does seem to be the one where vaccines are. All of the variants do have this effect where the vaccine in lab studies is not as effective, but there's a threshold within human bodies that seems to be the case that they are still effective. But the South African variant does appear, based on the literature, to be the one that's worrying most public health officials.
Yeah, they may have to come out with a new version of the vaccine to cover
What's your take on the public health policy that South Africa halted use of their vaccine because it wasn't as effective on mild and moderate cases?
Yeah, so that's interesting. Yeah, I don't know, to be honest with you. I think the question is, what's the alternative? Are they doing that so they could do something else? Or
exactly.
Just saying it's not
like,
working?
Isn't it still better to prevent death? Because it still seems to work against severe cases and significantly reduces hospitalization and death.
Yeah, which is critical, obviously.
Right?
That sounds ridiculous.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's obviously lots of countries around the world that are all grappling with the hard choices in different ways. Some countries are talking about, well, let's just give everybody one dose and not give them the second dose, and then we'll go back.
Or mix and match.
But I think, I don't know. I'm very uncomfortable with that because the timing is not just about, it's not just about giving them two doses. The timing itself is important, and you can't just delay it for a couple of months and think it's going to be as effective.
Yeah, if you don't test it, who knows? You know, how do you can only speculate as to if it's how much less effective or even more effective it might be.
It's like, we know that there's, we know that the way that it was done in lab trials, or not in lab trials, in human trials, is effective. We know that. We have good data to show.
94% whatever.
95%.
Absolutely. That we have good effectiveness data against the strain that existed at the time, or the strains that existed at the time, because there's probably more out there that we just haven't done. Genomic.
I mean, there's thousands of strains out there. We are sequencing them. It's just that these are the ones that have different properties or more contagious, et cetera.
But beyond the fact that the vaccines work, and they work when given the way that they were, you know, designed to work and the way that they were tested to work, beyond that, we're kind of in a big experiment right now.
Yeah.
And we're collecting data as we go.
But I think sticking with what we know works, just give people the two doses timed the way they're supposed to be, just ramp up the efforts to get it out there. You know, that's the no-brainer. You know, we really should be shooting for two, like in the U.S., for 2 million doses a day. You know, that's the pace that we need to keep ahead of these new variants.
And now, at least in our country, we're seeing that there is policy in place. There's a more organized, from the very top, a more organized effort. Obviously, it takes a little bit of time to get a whole new strategy going. But I don't know. My hope is that with strategy and with policy and with concerted, focused messaging and efforts, that it will become more streamlined.
So we'll have to keep track of this. I did get my second dose last week. You know, Carrie, you spoke about your second dose. I had the exact same reaction you did.
Ooh, wasn't it bad?
I mean, it wasn't that it was that bad. It was like definitely it was chills, fevers, and the worst muscle aches I think I've ever had.
Where were the aches, Steve?
It was just the whole body muscle ache, you know,
and malaise.
But the worst for me was that I just couldn't sleep. You know?
Oh, I was able to sleep. I took a bath first. The worst for me was the teeth chattering.
I didn't
just
have like
wow,
yeah, really my chills.
Yeah,
were not
just
that
the uncomfortable
bad,
chills and chattering teeth. So the bath really, really helped with that aspect of the fever. You know, the hot, cold malaise, grossness. Yeah. Taking a warm bath helped me a lot to relax.
But it was 48 hours. After 48 hours, I was 100%. You know, that was it. It was
that's good.
Mine was over the weekend, so it wasn't a problem.
It was acute for 12, and then fine for like, and then bad for 72, and then I was fine.
Okay. So these are all benign, but you just got to be aware that they're going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, time it accordingly. Okay, let's move on with some news items. Jay, you're going to tell us why people are so bad at detecting lies.
So the question is, do you think that you personally, guys, can tell when somebody is lying to you by their body language and their voice and everything?
Oh, yeah. Especially lawyers.
It depends for me. But I have heard about patients who have like damage to certain pathways that are way better or worse at detecting that. So I think there's some... I don't know, capability that we do have. I just think it varies from person to person.
Yeah, I can say, Jay, and you guys, and Jay, you would agree, you would actually know these people too. There's a couple people I know that if you just assume everything they say is a lie, you'll be correct 99% of the time.
So there's that too, yeah.
You won't be disappointed either.
So for me, I would say that, I think first of all, most people probably overestimate their ability to detect if other people are lying. But for me, if I know somebody well, I learn how to tell if that person is lying, like people I know very well. I don't think I could do it to strangers because who knows?
Agree. You know. That's why I love playing poker in home games with people I know. It's much more interesting to me than playing with a bunch of random strangers because you don't know them.
You can build them better.
Yeah, it's like all their tells are random and arbitrary. But when you really get to know somebody, poker becomes a much more complex game.
And in the world of accounting, when you're looking at numbers and things people are putting down, you do recognize certain patterns and things that sometimes don't make sense. I wouldn't necessarily call that lying, but you know when someone is exaggerating. I mean, that can definitely be discerned.
Yeah, that what you just talked about, Ev, is probably a little divergent from the news item, but I do think it's interesting because you have this huge mass of information over the years of doing it. You're finding some patterns that are present. But, you know, this is fascinating, right? You can sometimes feel like that being able to tell if someone's lying or whatever. It's like a superpower almost. You know, like as an example, I have a very strong belief that my father was very capable of telling if people were lying. And I also think my wife is exceptionally good at it.
Jay, he knew when you were lying.
Yeah.
he was probably pretty good at that.
But I also believe that I am very bad. I pick up almost nothing.
That's an interesting point, though, with our dad, because there's reading people, and then there is being savvy enough to know when the content of the claim is probably not true.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think dad was good at reading the situation, like knowing when and how somebody would be bullshitting rather than necessarily reading their tells. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
That's more like what Evan was saying. Like it's more the pattern of the claim, not so much the body language.
Yeah, and there is a difference between them, which you'll see in a minute. This topic is actually so interesting that they've made TV shows about it, and it comes up in movies all the time. Yeah. You know, there's something pretty cool when a character is like, you know, they can tell when somebody's lying, and I've felt that cool factor many, many times while watching TV shows and movies. So there's something there, like humans identify with this, that, you know, it's something that people think about and talk about. So let me give you a little background on this topic. First, of course, historically, there are references showing that people have been trying to be able to detect lying in some form or another for a very, very, very long time in human history. People have even created, you know, in the last 100 years, we created the lie detector machines, like your heart rate, how fast are you breathing, you know, trying to find patterns that can show if someone's lying. And research has shown that lie detectors are in no way reliable, just to make that perfectly clear. But what about people's ability to detect lies or the truth from watching people talk and move their body? Paul Ekman is a psychologist and an anthropologist. And he's the first researcher to do a large-scale study about how changes to his subjects' facial expressions and body movements reflect if they're telling the truth or if they're lying. So this, you know, back in the 1960s is when he kicked this off, and he came up with a theory that there are universal facial expressions for all of the basic emotions, you know, like fear, anger, sadness, disgust, surprise, enjoyment, you know, nothing really complicated, just the ones that basically all humans feel and that we all can easily identify. You know, when somebody describes disgust as an example, and there is a face that kind of goes with it, right? That you could, somebody has the disgusting face on, you know, that's pretty universal. He went on to categorize all of the facial muscles that are involved in creating these expressions that go along with particular emotions. And at its core, his idea is that when someone is actively trying to hide their emotions, that they're actually feeling, not that they're trying to feel, but that they're actually feeling, that there are body movements and facial expressions that can sometimes reveal these emotions without the subject knowing. So as an example, a person can have a facial expression that could last less than half a second. And to an untrained eye, these expressions could go completely unnoticed. And this is what Paul Ekman's research went into and believes. He's also stated that these micro expressions, they don't happen that often. And when someone's trying to fake emotion, there might be a missing facial expression or body movement that would be expected when a particular emotion occurs, right? So I guess that would be the tell that they're lying. In one of his books, he claims that laboratory experiments on truth and lies can be independently distinguished by reading facial expressions alone. And he said that he could be 80% accurate. And he said this accuracy goes up to 90% if he factors in body movements, voice, and language used. 90%.
So, is this also the case, though, during traumatic experiences? Because I feel like one of the fears that I have listening to this kind of research is that this would be used during interrogation, right? As a tool for police interrogation.
Sure. Oh,
yeah. And what I often see in misuse of sort of like, you know, the pseudoscience of body language is that there's an expected reaction. And if somebody doesn't fit the mold of what the police or the, you know, quote, experts in the room think is the expected reaction, that they must be lying or they must, you know, be withholding. When during traumatic experiences, people react funny.
Yeah. Well, let me.
Sure.
Let me go into it because I'm actually going to talk about that a little bit.
Oh, okay. Good.
Maria Hartwig of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice thinks that Ekman's statistics are incorrect, and in her words, said that they were simply implausible. Research literature in the field demonstrates that success rates are barely above chance, and Ekman has not published a study that confirms the figures that he claims.
That's worrisome. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, very.
So a legal psychologist, Christina Suchotsky, of Johannes Gutenberg University, Mainz in Germany, stated that many researchers don't take Ekman's beliefs in micro expressions seriously. He doesn't have empirical evidence. And as an example, if somebody is showing signs of being uneasy or anxious during an interview, right, Kara, or even an interrogation, that by itself is not a reason to believe they're lying. It doesn't mean that you can infer truth or lies from a perceived emotion, right? So like what Kara was saying, the investigator—
Or lack of emotion, like a flatness, which is very common during trauma.
Yeah, and if you're having a panic attack and you're acting strange or maybe—
And also, if based on your race, based on your age, you're afraid of police—
Yeah.
You know, there are so many different factors in why somebody would have an emotional reaction sitting in an interrogation room.
You have a very wide swing of emotion, too. You know, there's so much variability in this. What a lot of other psychologists are saying is that, you know, it's just unpredictable. So of the few independent studies about microexpressions, researchers found that microexpressions were witnessed in 22% of all test subjects, and they showed up both when people were trying to cover up their feelings or telling the truth. So Ekman and his critics both agree, though, that humans on average were bad. Most people in the field agree that we're bad at detecting if we're being lied to. A meta-analysis included 25,000 test subjects and concluded that people guess correctly 54% of the time. Guys, that's just a little bit above chance. It's a little bit better than chance.
Slightly better than a coin flip, yeah.
Now get ready. Here's all the things that are going to make everybody question what they said at the beginning of my news item. So oddly, when tested only hearing the person's voice, the success rate went up to 63%. The researchers said that the imagery actually distracts the viewer from noticing vocal cues, and I guess the vocal cues are more reliable. And most interesting for me was that even people who deal with having to determine lies or the truth professionally, like who? A psychiatrist, a judge, a police officer, they could not score better than randomly selecting a person off the street.
Oh, interesting.
And how about if we test parents against their kids, right? So you take parents and they do a study to see if they can detect better than other parents or, say, undergraduate students who are in every experiment in the world. Do you guys think that parents could detect their children's lies, because they know them so well, better than other parents or undergraduate students?
Not necessarily, because kids are obvious when they're lying, so everyone's probably responding to the same clues, you know?
That's what they want you to think, Steve. So in a test of 8 to 16-year-old children and teenagers, the parents were no better than anyone else. And check this out. The researchers stated that the parents actually tended to believe their kids more. Because it's their kids.
Not my baby.
Yes, exactly.
Not my baby.
Exactly.
My little peaches is precious.
There are many psychologists studying this subject matter, and the pattern is that there is no airtight, you know, way to tell right now that if someone's telling the truth or not, because there's all these studies that are going on, and sometimes they show a little like, oh, look, this is good. This is kind of positive. And then it doesn't pan out. They haven't really found anything that is airtight yet. Which there might not be. There might not be these tells. There might not be something coming out of us. You know, the variability is way too high. People are different. People are, you know, react differently in different circumstances. So I guess there isn't really these predictable things that we haven't found anything yet that is reliable. And again, it's, you know, 54%. That's guesswork. That's just guesswork.
Can I give you guys an anecdote?
Absolutely.
That's the thing. You can't tell what's going on inside somebody's head, right? And I often think of actors because, you know, actors are in a way lying, right? They're pretending to have emotions, whatever. How do they do that? They learn how to actually feel the things that they're trying to simulate. So Evan Jay and I, and Bob a little bit, used to LARP. How many times, guys, have you heard, on multiple occasions, I've heard people say, well, this person can't be lying. Nobody is that good an actor. And meanwhile, right. I'm thinking, we're all acting. None of this is real.
Oh my God.
So how can you make that argument? You know, but of course that's out of game. So you don't say it, but I'm thinking, you know, it's not real either way. Come on, dude. You know, the fact is you can, you know, act really well by getting in the moment and, you know, forcing yourself or whatever, pretending to believe the thing that you're saying. That's how people beat lie detector tests, you know? Right. So I don't think there's ever going to be any tell like that. It's just too complicated to figure out, to infer what's really going on inside somebody's head.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
But I got to tell you guys, like, everybody out there that's listening to this, I believe most people will like go, yeah, I agree with average people, but you know, I'm a lawyer or I'm a police officer and I can tell, you know, like they'll dismiss this and won't include themselves because they think that they've, you know, they've got a bead on this and they know what they're
talking
about.
It's an argument from authority.
And again, another example of humility, just because you're a judge or a professional that deals with people lying all the time, you know, doesn't mean that you're actually doing it. You know, you might have to check yourself and say, wait a second, maybe, you know, I'm completely wrong. Maybe I can't do this well.
That's a good point, Jay. And our magician colleagues would say, because they've told this to us, they're easier to fool because they're more predictable.
Right.
You know, the children are the hardest to fool in some ways. That's not the same as lying, but still.
Right. Like just, they're not tied to reality.
Yeah. The experts in this case may be at a disadvantage because they're more predictable, at least to somebody who knows how to deceive professionally.
There was an interesting thing that happens when somebody can't understand the words that somebody's telling them, like they get mixed up or they don't make a lot of sense. They have a difficulty understanding speech. They tend to develop a talent for reading faces more because they need those peripheral cues.
Yeah, there have been studies of that, you know, in terms of at least psychologically, neurologically, not necessarily in the context of lie detecting. Along those lines, I remember looking at people. So there are people who have strokes who independently will like lose their ability to understand words, but they can still understand the emotional content of speech. Right. And then others have the flip where they can't understand the emotional content, but they can understand the words because they lateralize to two different hemispheres.
Yeah.
And there was, and
it's like typing in all caps all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if it was a study or just like an evaluation of patients who had the lesion where they couldn't understand the inflection, the emotional content of speech. So
the prosody.
It was like, and they were listening to a politician.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. That's what I was trying to reference.
Okay.
So they were listening.
And they were like, this guy is so full of shit because they couldn't be deceived by the emotional manipulation of the speech. They were just hearing the words, and the words sounded like BS. But in the context of the emotional appeal behind the words, they put a totally different context to it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's what you were thinking of. Okay.
That's what I was thinking of, because I was like, he was like a politician on mute. And then I was like, nope, that wasn't it. I need to look this up.
That was it. Yeah, I heard the same study.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, I think Oliver Sacks writes about it in one of his books too. So it must have been like a case study. And then he wrote about it. Or maybe it was his case study. It could have been.
All right, let's move on. Kara.
Yes.
Should I go to a sauna to get detoxed?
Will saunas detox you? What does that even mean? You guys have heard of infrared saunas, right?
Oh, yeah.
No.
Have any of you ever used an infrared sauna? Like when you were at a spa and you just wanted to warm up?
No.
Don't know that I've ever used a sauna.
Oh, you've never used a sauna?
No more of the steam with the rocks and stuff?
Yeah, infrared, that's the difference. You hit the nail on the head. Or, as you would put it, Bob, you hit the nail on the button. Sorry, I had to. What is an infrared sauna? How does it work? Well, there's a major difference. And Bob, you pointed out to it specifically. How does a traditional sauna work? How does it heat you up?
It's steam. It's the
superheats water. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's either water or there's a heat source, but the air in the sauna is hot.
Yes.
Right? Why they're hot. It's like 200 degrees in there. An infrared sauna. Yeah, Fahrenheit. Thank you, Evan. An infrared sauna uses light instead of heat. And so because it uses light, it doesn't have to operate as high a temperature for your own benefit of like that feeling of warmth to happen. And so people are enjoying infrared saunas because they're a little bit more comfortable. The problem is there are claims that the quote, light penetrates skin more deeply than the heat of a traditional sauna, which leads to more sweat, which leads to a more abundant release of toxins.
Mm. Oh, God.
Yeah. And that feeds back to exactly what you were asking, Steve, which is, do you go to a sauna to eliminate toxins? And this is an honest question. Why does this claim persist? Why does it work on people?
It's the toxin gambit.
Why does the toxin gambit work?
I think it triggers our sense of disgust, you know, getting back to that.
We hate the word toxin.
It's so good. Yeah, so here's what Higher Dose publishes. This is a very famous place where you can go and sit in an infrared sauna. This is what they publish on their website. Sweat induced from an infrared heat source is comprised of 20% toxins, whereas sweat induced from traditional heating systems is comprised of 3% toxins. This is why it's accurate to say infrared is 7 times more detoxifying than traditional heat.
Oh, my God.
This is an actual claim on their website.
They don't identify specific toxins. They don't identify doses. It's just toxins as a sort of a vague ooze.
Generic
that,
thing.
And this random
bad energy.
Yeah, exactly.
This random percentage thing. So this is great because this woman who wrote this amazing Atlantic article, which is hilarious. Her name's Kelly Conaboy. I highly recommend you read it. She was digging deep into the infrared sauna, you know, movement. And she was like, well, okay, this seems like fun. I'm going to go sit in this. Does it feel good? Sure. Is it actually doing anything? Probably not, but let's find out. So she reaches out to some scientists who wrote the textbook, Vander's Human Physiology, The Mechanisms of Body Function. And she said, hey, I'm a little confused. You guys write about sweat and the components of sweat and what is sweat and this 20% versus 3% distinction of toxins and sweat. Apparently, like almost all infrared heat sauna retailers offer this on their website. And she's like, there's no citation. I don't understand this. But she found one case where there was an internal citation, and it was this Vander's Human Physiology textbook. So she finds the authors, and she's like, hey, got some questions for you, reaches out to them and asks them, is this claim substantiated? I can't find it in the book. Did you write about it? And all of them were like, no. First of all, no idea what you're talking about. Second of all, yes, we talk about the components of sweat, which is salt, sodium and chloride, and tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of lead, copper, and nickel, which can appear in your sweat.
That's right, but copper.
If you've got a lot of copper in your sweat, you need to go to the doctor, which is actually what they say. If you have high amounts of these things, that's probably a problem.
There's your talk.
Don't go to a sauna, go to a hospital. That was the actual quote. But they were like, no, sweat is salt. Like, and sweat actually isn't there to remove toxins. That's the other thing.
To cool you down.
They were like, yeah, right? Sweat, no, the function of sweat is to cool you down. Mm-hmm. That's the reason physiologically that we sweat. It's not to release toxins. Yet continually you see these claims. And of course, anytime there's a new, quote, technology or a new fad, they utilize these claims. And it's frustrating because there's this crossover effect, right? Like, I don't see anything wrong with when you go to the spa to relax for the day. Oh, God, I miss spas, you guys. I think this is like a very triggering news item for me. When you go to the spa to relax for a day, to sit in the hot tub, to maybe get a massage, to do some, you know, self-care, sitting quietly with your own thoughts, and you want to get in the sauna and you want to get really warm in the sauna and it feels really good to you, great. Why does it have to be ruined by people talking about the, you know, the bullshit benefits and sweating out toxins and you know, it's seven times more effective at sweating out toxins. I love this quote, by the way. This is a quote by somebody, I think, yeah, at Higher Dose, who says, because this researcher or this writer asked him to elaborate. Quote, it penetrates your body 3 inches deep to pull toxins out of your fat cells, which is a big deal. Normally, when you sweat, it's a more superficial sweat. Not only that, but normally working out is one of the other big times people think they're releasing toxins. But when your body's in fight or flight, it actually doesn't release toxins. It's only when your body is in rest and digest mode that it actually releases toxins. So that's one of the key misconceptions about sweating and working out. I might say the key misconception about release of toxins is that we have organs within our body that filter our blood, and their job is to remove toxic substances that can actually make us very sick. We don't sweat out toxins, and sweating at a lower temperature doesn't make you sweat out more toxins. It's simply a lie. It's a gimmick, and it pisses me off that this is able to go sort of just like unchallenged.
So, Kara, you probably know this, but just to point this out, the whole notion of a spa began as a medical scam and has been one its entire existence. Spas exist as a way of marketing medical scams.
Bullshit.
The Roman baths.
The modern incarnation as a place to relax and get a massage, whatever, is like a superficial secondary function now. That's more recent marketing. Spas have always been health spas. They've always been about nonsensical health claims.
Which is why, of course,
for the worried well and people with more dollars than cents.
You're so right, because it's so hard even. Like, I've definitely been to been to spas where they're pretty like bare bones, and it's just get a massage, sit in the hot tub, take a shower, go home. But I've also been to spas where you're like, why is this on the menu? Like, the menu is like, you know, two massages and a scrub, or other places where the menu is like craniosacral therapy.
Yeah. And reflexology.
Reflexology, Reiki.
Always reflexology.
Rolfing, cupping.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. All the things. Cupping. And it sucks. Those are the spas I don't go to. I go to Korean spas.
That's closer
to the
roots. They
actually have a lot of woo, too.
Yeah. I haven't, you know, seen a spa that didn't have the pseudoscience at some level.
You know what we should do, you guys? We should open an SGU spa where it's really just for resting, relaxing, meditating.
Science-based.
A science-based spa.
Yeah. Now, like, we have a friend who's a yoga instructor, and she's like, God, it's so rife with pseudoscience. And she wants to start a science-based yoga class where
that's
it's
Shannon.
Like yoga. Yeah, no, yoga without the bullshit, without the chi and the thing and the energy and whatever.
I have a friend who offered that to me and an ex-boyfriend once. We were doing yoga a lot, and we were like, we can't deal with the bullshit. So we hired this girl who's a yoga instructor, and we were like, you know, come to the house, offer us yoga, but we will only do this if you make it atheist yoga. And that was the goal. And it was like purely devoid of any spiritual mumbo jumbo. And I loved it. Atheist yoga was my jam.
Yeah, right.
Goat yoga, atheist
yoga? Goat yoga is pretty funny too. I've never done it, but I want to. Don't you want cute little goats crawling all over you during yoga?
Goats?
I don't know. I don't think so.
You've never seen? Yeah, because you know goats, they jump on things. And so the goat yoga
goat
is like a...
jumping on you?
Yeah, but like little cute ones.
Yeah. Like miniature, like animacule goats.
Animacule goats.
Ooh, virtual goats.
All right.
Please.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Bombas Socks.
Guys, we've talked about Bombas Socks before because we wear them and we really, really do love these socks. I mean, this company has literally thought about every little detail of socks and they've improved it just to make them more comfortable because, of course, they know people want to wear comfortable socks.
They do a lot more than just help keep your feet cozy. They give back to the most vulnerable members of our community because for every pair of socks you buy, Bombas donates a pair to someone in need. And the generosity of you, the Bombas customers, has allowed them to donate over 40 million pairs of socks and counting through their national network of over 3,000 giving partners. Remember, to those experiencing homelessness, these socks represent the dignity of putting on clean clothes, a small comfort that's especially important right now.
Give a pair when you buy a pair and get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/skeptics. That's bombas.com/skeptics for 20% off your first purchase. bombas.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Bob,
yeah,
you're going to shift focus here quite a bit. Tell us about...
Oh, yeah, it's a big shift.
How we can get energy out of black holes.
Oh, toxins. It must be toxins.
It must be toxins.
Yeah.
And put that
sweat the toxins
back
out of them
into the
and you're
spa.
Good. That's right.
That's right, Kappa.
Yeah, I just love this news item so, so much. So a recent Columbia study showed that tremendous energy can be extracted from a black hole through the reconnection of magnetic field lines. So how is this helpful in any way, and what might it mean to humanity if we survive the greatest filter there is, time, and live far, far into the future? This is from a study published in the journal Physical Review D. Physicist Luca Comiso, who's from Columbia University, and Felipe Aseño from University Adolfo Ibanez in Chile. So as I said, this new study describes a new way to extract energy from black holes. Sounds bizarre, right? How do you get anything out of, you know, a black hole which sucks everything in? And to do it, the theory is by breaking and rejoining magnetic field lines near an event horizon. Holy crap.
Wait, so, what? That doesn't sound possible. Is that possible?
Well, let's go through it, shall we? So first we got to do a little foundational explanation. So magnetic field lines, you know, what are magnetic field lines? Well, the lines themselves, they're not real. They represent a given magnetic field. And we've all seen the drawings of a bar magnet, with the lines going to the north and south pole.
Yeah,
And they're there to show the strength and the direction of the field. The closer the lines, the stronger the field. So if you had a compass and you move the compass around, it would basically follow the field lines. So that's basically what they're talking about. That's what a magnetic field line is. But magnetic reconnection is probably less well known. But this is a fundamental process in nature. It occurs all the time in stars and around our own magnetosphere, around the Earth and elsewhere. So to visualize what magnetic reconnection is, imagine oppositely directed field lines that collide and then explosively reconnect. Now, when that happens, it releases a lot of energy that is then transferred to anything that's nearby, like particles, that which may be accelerated away at tremendous energies. Now, you've heard of solar flares and CMEs, coronal mass ejections. Right? Mm-hmm. We've talked about it on the show.
Oh, yeah.
Magnetic reconnection makes all of them happen. That's all because of magnetic reconnection. That's what's powering them. So the fact that these researchers are invoking the use of energy from magnetic reconnection, it's not theoretical or esoteric. You know, something that's rarely found in nature. They're very common. They're everywhere. Now to black holes. Now black holes, they're much harder to study than stars, obviously, but it's widely believed that reconnection can happen in black holes as well. They're often surrounded by magnetized plasma particles, after all. And we've seen very often we come across black hole jets and gamma radiation that's being released near a black hole. So the overwhelming likelihood is that they are caused as well by this magnetic reconnection. So that's pretty solid. There is magnetic reconnection happening all over and most likely around black holes as well. So what is the benefit of this theory? You may say, who cares? And come on, Kara, I know you're thinking it. But regarding that very question, one of the scientists said that this finding could allow astronomers to estimate the spin of black holes better, drive black hole energy emissions, and might even provide a source of energy for the needs of an advanced civilization. So I'll repeat that last bit. provide a source of energy for the needs of an advanced civilization. Now, that, of course, that's the sentence. That's the part of the sentence that really grabbed me hard. The rabbit hole of implications and scientific theory behind what that actually means is so fascinating. And I'm going to share that with you in excruciatingly cool detail. So we're talking about harvesting energy from a black hole, right? This is what we're talking about here. So that idea comes from none other than our buddy Albert Einstein. His general relativity predicted that rotating black holes would have vast stores of energy that could be tapped like a keg. I don't think he used that analogy, but it's apt. Since then, though, many theories have been put forth of how to extract energy from a black hole. And so this one is just one of the latest ways that this has been envisaged. So this latest theory is similar to some of the other ideas in that it essentially is stealing rotational energy, angular momentum from the black hole. That's what's basically happening. This is where the energy is coming from, the spin of the black hole. Now, we're talking about a lot of angular momentum, right? Some black holes spin at millions of times per second. Millions. That is fast. Think of the mass. You know, millions or billions of solar masses worth of mass spinning at millions of times per second. Now, interestingly, this is called, they call this a ringularity because you can't have a point singularity, right? Isn't that great?
I love that.
Right?
Wow,
that's awesome. You can't have a point particle rotating. I mean, that wouldn't really work mathematically. So they envision it as like a ring of matter. So the new theory now is similar to this, but it's on mega steroids. So what they do is, in their theory, they're talking about taking advantage of the black hole's ergosphere. Now, I wasn't too familiar with this area of a black hole, but imagine you've got the event horizon, right? The point, it's not really a thing. It's basically the area around the singularity where once you pass that, you can never – all paths lead to the singularity. You're
like
not getting
no
out.
Return.
You have to basically go faster than the speed. That's the event horizon. Right outside of that is the ergosphere. Now, in this area is distinguished because the frame dragging, it actually is spinning so strongly and so fast that it drags space-time along with it. So imagine, you know, you have a blender and you're making cake and the batter, the way it kind of scrunches up and spins with it and drags the distant batter along with it. That's kind of like what frame dragging is, but you're doing it to space-time. So this is happening in the ergosphere just outside of the event horizon. It's basically swirling space-time at near the speed of light. So anything that's in that area, you're going to go for a ride. You have no choice if you're going through the ergosphere. It's just going to – space-time is just going to be swirling around, and you cannot stay stationary with respect to I believe, the singularity in the middle. So now if we could make magnetic reconnection happen in the ergosphere – now I know that's a big thing. How the hell are you going to make magnetic reconnection happen in the ergosphere around a black hole? That's not the point here. The point is that if that happened, it happens, and if we could induce it somehow with some technology, then two things would happen. So you'd have magnetic fields reconnecting right outside the event horizon. Lots of energy is released, right? That's what happens during this magnetic reconnection. So what would happen if you do that near a black hole? So this is what would happen. Two things would happen. First off, you'd have regular positive energy plasma particles, right? These are plasma particles, magnetized particles that are already in the area. They would accelerate with the spin of the black hole, right? And that would accelerate them greatly. So you have these particles that are given a kick of energy, and then that energy is amped up even more by the spin of the frame dragging around the black hole. But something else happens if you do this just right. You would have basically negative energy plasma particles would go in the opposite direction. They would go in the opposite direction of the spin of the black hole. Now, a negative energy particle, you might say, well, what the hell is that? That is a thing. Negative energy particles are a thing in quantum mechanics, and it's so fascinating. Just real quick, it's been shown that energy can actually be barred from the vacuum under certain conditions. If you're dealing with a very, very short time in an environment that's where quantum mechanics is like ruling the roost, it's like this is what quantum mechanics is doing. There's really no classical mechanics happening here. It's all quantum. And then the energy has to be such that there's a compensating positive energy flow. So that's exactly what happened with the positive plasma particles, right? So you got the negative and the positive. They need to be there. So this can only really happen around the ergosphere. This is a very special scenario that they think can't happen really anywhere else except right here in the ergosphere. So then what happens is that the negative particles, right? You got the negative particles going one way, the opposite of the frame dragging, and the positive particles going the other way. The negative particles get swallowed by the black hole. The positive particles are ejected. They leave because they got so much energy. They're leaving the ergosphere, but they've got far more energy than it took to accelerate them. So, and that's because of the spin of the black hole. Now, we're talking about an efficiency of 150%. That's obviously much higher than any power plant on the Earth. 150%. How is that possible? That's possible because you're siphoning the rotational energy. That you're basically stealing that rotational energy from the black hole, and you're giving it to those positive energy particles that then leave the black hole, and it's that extra energy that's being taken advantage of. That's exactly, so that's the source of power, all of this energy that's coming, that's being taken advantage of.
They just gave the free energy gurus a new line to go
with. Well,
yeah,
but it's not really free. You're just siphoning the spin off of the black hole. Now, if you do this long enough, you will entirely remove the spin of the black hole. It will no longer be a rotating black hole. But, I mean, so what? Who cares, first of all? And secondly, you could power your house for a billion years, and the black hole would barely slow down. I mean, you would have a lot of energy for a really long time. Now, this, of course, is not a project that is in President Biden's budget or any other government's energy budget, for obvious reasons, because we're just not even anywhere near being able to do anything like this. But if we know what to look for, we could use this information that we know about the black holes to detect a civilization that's advanced enough to bleed a black hole like this to support their alien civilization. So this idea could actually be used to support an alien society. If they're like, hey, let's find the best battery in the known universe, they would be hanging out by a black hole, assuming that they're advanced enough to even do anything like this. But there's another way to look at this, not just looking for an alien now, but looking deep into the future. You know, we're really spoiled by our universe. There's a septillion stars out there, and they're geysers of tappable energy. Its energy is everywhere. I call this the happy fun time epic of the universe. But mm-hmm. if you're a professional, you don't call it that. You call it the stelliferous era of the universe. Lots of stars everywhere. Stelliferous, I think, is
that sounds almost as ridiculous to me, that word.
It's a pretty word.
But wait, are they suggesting that we're in kind of a time of peak stardom?
Essentially, especially compared to the deep future, because the time's going to come when all the bright stars are gone. A human would look out into space and see nothing. No stars. Basically,
oh my God, how sad.
If you go,
we're talking 10 trillion years.
But still,
it's sad.
It is sad. But hey, it's going to suck. And it'd be cool to see it, though. But you won't be seeing much. This is what you would see. If you looked out into space, you would see black holes. You would see degenerate stars, and you'd see bits of plastic floating everywhere. Not really, but you know. So this is called the degenerate era. You were close, Evan, not a 10 trillion. That's about 100 trillion years in the future. This is the degenerate era. And yeah, it's not going to be fun because if you're a super advanced, high power requirement civilization, you can't tap into solar energy. You can't create Dyson spheres or Dyson swarms, more accurately. You can't tap into any stars, really, because there's no stars. There's no active stars. There's no fusion happening like it's happening right now. So if you want to, if you want to live in the way that you've grown accustomed to, then building a civilization around a black hole and harvesting its energy, that's going to be the way to go. That's going to be how you could do this.
I wonder if that's ever been a subject of a science fiction story.
It has. I listened to one on Escape Pod many years ago. I don't remember too much about it. It was a really cool story about this kind of idea. And I'm going to have to look it up and try to find out what the name is again. So how much energy? The next question for me was, how much energy are we talking about? Is it even worth it? You know, how much energy can you actually pull out of a black hole? Because, I mean, imagine the scale and the complexity of creating structures around a black hole and poking at it. Like, you know, poking at that to try to pull some energy out of it. You know, is it even worth it?
Right, but wouldn't you get all the energy you could possibly need?
Yes. And how much energy? And how much energy would that be? So, but I'm curious. Yeah, I knew that there was a lot. And I knew that it's probably going to be worth it. But I was really more curious about how much are we talking about. So that's what this is what I figured out. This is what I figured out. So to see if it's worth it, I looked Bob's at the formula. Supermassive star at the center of our Milky Way. What's the name of our supermassive black hole at the center of our Milky Way?
The Milky
Sagittarius
Hole?
Sagittarius A.
Close, Steve. Sagittarius B? A Sagittarius star. It's called B. Sagittarius A star.
That's well, I'm glad it's not called the Milky Hole, because that's
Milky,
not
Milky Hole.
So this is, you know, in terms of black holes, it's okay. You know, it's 4 million solar masses. It's a lot. You know, it's not the biggest, not even close to the biggest, but let's work with that one. So we can theoretically steal the energy from it that's equivalent to, here it is, what all the stars in the Milky Way emit in a billion years. So that's what one of these scientists said we could take from our supermassive black hole. What all the stars in the Milky Way emit in a billion years. Well, how much is that? Because when I read that, you know I took that as a challenge. I had to find out exactly what that number is. I had to convert that into a crazy high number that sounds cool, but you can't really wrap your head around, because that's what I do. So
does it end in tillion?
So I found this. I found that our galaxy emits 5 × 10⁶ joules per second. So a joule is a tiny amount of work. It's about 1/3600th of a watt hour. Super tiny, but we're talking about 10⁶ of that. So that's a lot. So I converted that into a billion years. If that's 1 second's worth, what is it equivalent to in a billion years? So I did the easy math, and I came up with 1.57 × 10�53 joules. So that's the energy that we could extract from our black hole, our supermassive black hole. That's 158 hexadecillion joules. That's also, I know that doesn't mean shit, but hexadecillion.
Oh, no, this is a meaningless number to me, but it sounds
right,
really
no,
big.
Let's make it a little bit more, a little bit better then. It's something on the order of 100 billion trillion trillion quintillion joules.
There you go, Kara. That's
so
digestible.
I mean, that's a little bit, that gives you a better idea than hexadecillion.
Not really.
So, all right, how about
this?
At least
he used words we understand.
Yeah, I know those words.
All right, yes. How about this then? How about in terms of Star Wars? You know the Death Star's super laser, right?
Yes, I do know that.
So the Alderaan knows it all too well.
So it's if you consider the maximum output of a Death Star's super laser, the energy you can pull from that from the supermassive black hole would be 15 orders of magnitude greater than that.
Mm.
So,
and you know what else, Bob? It's insignificant compared to the power of
the Force.
Yes,
yes, of course. So, but now in my final attempt to put this huge amount of energy into context, this one might be better. If we could make the Milky Way's supermassive black hole our personal generator, using these numbers and this theory, we could run our world at current energy levels for a billion trillion trillion years.
That's great. So, can we use it to stop the sun from expanding and exploding?
So that's the kind of energy we're talking about. I mean, sure, our energy needs are going to go up, but who cares? I mean, running the Earth for a billion trillion trillion years, that's such a gargantuan amount of energy. But it's fascinating. I find it very interesting to consider, you know, the kind of civilization that could take advantage of it, and maybe taking advantage of it right now. We may find, you know, a black hole in the future that gives the telltale emissions of some civilization that is harvesting the energy from it. How amazing would that be? And this could be happening right now in our universe, in our galaxy, potentially. It's interesting to think that it could happen in 100 trillion years when there's no other sources of energy in the universe. And it's this very sad place. But it could be cool, because you're living around a black hole.
Don't get too close.
I suspect that's a non-trivial engineering challenge.
I would be horrified every second of my existence if I was orbiting a black hole.
All right. So, guys, this is an interesting item. We haven't talked a lot about fantasy-prone personality, but this is something that's really interesting and is very important for understanding parapsychology or, you know, psi phenomenon. There's a recent study looking at it, which is why I'm bringing it up now, but let me give you a little bit of background. So in 1981, this goes back a ways, 1981, Cheryl Wilson and Theodore Barber first reported what they called fantasy-prone personality, or FPP. This emerged, you know, from the research that they were doing, looking at like what kind of people are more likely to be hypnotized, right? What makes somebody a good hypnosis subject? And they found about 4% of the population were like really easily hypnotized. They had a heightened ability to imagine themselves in a situation, to engage in fantasy. And eventually they put together this profile that they called the fantasy-prone personality, that with the following features. So one is they're an excellent hypnotic subject. Two is they have imaginary friends in childhood. Three is they fantasizing often as a child. Four, having an actual fantasy identity. Five, experiencing imagined sensations as real. Six, having vivid sensory perceptions. And seven, receiving sexual satisfaction without physical stimulation.
Whoa.
So, sounds good to me.
Yeah. I know. I'm like, whoa. Tell me more about this, Steve.
Sign me up. How do you get to that point? Like, what do you got to do for that, Steve?
Well, Steve, let's throw that news item out. We got a new line of inquiry for you.
Yeah. Let's go right to work. It's actually interesting.
Let's take a left angle here. Left turn. All right. So their research also found that people who met a certain amount of criteria, you know, enough to qualify as having a fantasy-prone personality, were more likely to experience parapsychological phenomena, like to believe that they have ESP, for example, or that they are a spiritualist, or that they've seen a ghost. This was hit upon by paranormal investigators. Joe Nickel, for example, this is, I think, the person who I first learned about fantasy personality from, because he encountered a lot of them in his paranormal research, and he is fond of saying, there are no haunted houses, there are only haunted people,
yeah,
right?
Mm. Great quote. Still love that line.
Yeah, the phenomena surrounds the person. And he said, like, when you go in to investigate a haunt, whatever, it doesn't matter what it is, a haunted restaurant or whatever, there's always a fantasy-prone person in there. And when you trace all of the reports back to their source, they all go back to that one fantasy-prone person. They are driving all the phenomena. And that's what led him to that quote. The house isn't haunted. That person is generating all of the alleged haunting or whatever phenomena. Mm-hmm. Very, very, you know, I think useful insight into what's going on. And we experience this ourselves. So we have a much, you know, far more limited repertoire of investigations that we've done, but we pretty much have encountered the same thing. There's always that one person who is clearly driving things. So the question is, what is this? Is this not just, what is this as a phenomenon psychologically? So like, is this just one end of the bell curve, you know, of human variability? And it could be. We also talked previously on the show about aphantasia. You guys remember that?
Oh yeah. Mind's eye.
No, yeah, somebody yeah. unable to imagine things visually or mentally, like to conjure a mental image of something. And you wonder if these are just whatever, this is at two opposite ends of the spectrum, or if there's other things going on. It's not just that. So what are some other things? What are some other features? What could be a reason why this exists as a subset of humanity? One study found that people who rated very high on an FPP scale were better storytellers. Their stories were richer, more plausible, more emotionally compelling.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so you think that, you know, this is a valuable skill in human society. And so the features that make up fantasy-prone personality, we could easily see how they would be selected for or advantageous in a storytelling social culture like people. So this, I'm building towards the current study, which is looking more of like neurologically what's going on with these people, and specifically more towards those later criteria, not just somebody who fantasizes a lot, but somebody who has vivid sensory perceptions, right? More that fusing of imagination and physical reality. When you get to that extent, what's going on? So a recent review of fantasy-prone personality found that there were, you know, very large effect sizes for a correlation with hallucinatory experiences, in addition to magical ideation, perceptual aberration, dissociation, and excessive daydreaming. So again, there's this mix of just people who are in their head a lot fantasizing, and but also this blurring of the lines perceptually between fantasy and reality. This gets us to the recent study that wanted to see how far that goes, right? What about, do people with fantasy-prone personality have a higher correlation with either hearing voices, just straight up hearing voices, or having visual hallucinations?
Okay. Which is less common than hearing voices.
Yes, very much less. And they also looked at a trait called absorption. Absorption is the ability to become completely absorbed in one's own thoughts. And there are standard measures of that. That's like,
oh, like they can't see or hear anything that's happening around like them because they're so in their
exactly,
heads.
Exactly. So the researchers, Powell and Mosley, are the researchers who looked at the current study. They specifically looked at what they called non-pathological cases. So this means these are people who do not meet diagnostic criteria for schizophrenia or for having any pathology, right? Now, other than visual or auditory hallucinations, but they don't have other signs of pathology. So they were considered non-pathological cases. This is what they found. I'm just going to read you from the abstract. Spiritualist mediums completed an online questionnaire assessing the timing, nature, and frequency of their auditory, which they would call clairaudient, spiritual communications, including scales measuring paranormal beliefs, absorption, hallucination proneness, and aspects of identity. These measures were compared to a general population group with results showing higher levels of auditory hallucination proneness and absorption among the spiritualists, as well as correlations between spiritual beliefs and absorption, but not spiritual beliefs and hallucination proneness for the general population. But here's the thing, the spiritualists did not have a correlation with visual hallucinations. So it was purely auditory and not visual.
So what's going on in the brain?
So this was not surprising to me. I know, Carrie, you and I spoke about this previously. We were talking about this item that, or even related to other items, that the circuitry for visual hallucinations is very different from the circuitry for auditory hallucinations. And auditory hallucinations tend to be associated much, much more with thought, like with feeling, with ideation, whereas visual hallucinations tend to be more, you know, more of a perceptual phenomenon.
Although most of us have had auditory hallucinations before, maybe not a lot, but most of us have heard our phone ring when it wasn't, heard somebody say our name when they weren't. And it's much less common for somebody to say, oh yeah, I saw something that wasn't there.
Hey guys, do this experiment, guys. I've done this. I haven't done it in years, but I have done it a few times and it worked. When you're drifting off to sleep, when you're really kind of stew-nod and half awake and half asleep, think of your name and repeat it in your mind. And when I did that, I made myself hear it. Like I really felt like I was hearing it out loud. It was really cool.
Interesting.
Now, Kara, do you know this? As a neurologist, my training and my experience in reading is that the best way to distinguish hallucinations, whether auditory or visual, that is neurological versus psychiatric. So in other words, if there's
a
focal problem causing just a neurological phenomenon versus hallucinations.
Like a mini seizure or something.
That are associated, seizures are more complicated. So we'll put that aside.
Okay.
But what are associated would cause with schizophrenia, for example.
Yeah. I mean, I think all of my experience would be with schizophrenia. I know that there are situations when somebody's getting brain surgery where you can have like induced hallucinations from stimulation, but I didn't know that there were actual neurological phenomena of people.
Interpeduncular hallucinosis. That's a good neurological diagnosis. Ooh, that's a very focal lesion. Yeah. Now, here's the key difference. Neurological hallucinations have no emotional content, whereas psychiatric hallucinations do. So like if you have schizophrenia and you're hearing voices, those voices are talking to you.
Right.
And they're making you feel bad about yourself. And you think they're real, or that's more of a confusing point for you. Whereas neurologically, they're emotionally void. And I think probably partly because of that, you know they're not real. So they're experienced very differently, and you can usually easily tell the difference with a patient. Just ask them not only what was it like, but what it ha- Did you know that they were not there? Did you know the voices right. weren't real, the people weren't there? How did it make you feel? And they're like, no, nothing. It just like they're just worried that it means there's something wrong with their brain. And they're right, because there usually is.
Right. Whereas most of the patients I've worked with who have actual hallucinations have relationships with their voices.
Yeah. There's bizarre ideation. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of thought and feeling tied up in the hallucinations. It's not
just delusions.
An isolated circuit misfiring. It's much more integrated into this type of thing, right?
So is the same thing happening in the brain, though? Because if somebody's experiencing a hallucination, let's say a psychiatric hallucination, are they still not having activity in brain regions associated with processing, let's say, auditory phenomena
or vision? They're definitely neurologically different phenomena.
And okay.
They're just maybe some of the same circuitry is getting involved, but the neurological phenomena are much more focal, narrow, limited. Like, a circuit is misfiring,
and the psychiatric, in a neurological,
neurologically, but psychiatrically, it's a much more of a whole brain thing going on. Maybe like parts of the brain that are involved, but it's more complicated and involves multiple circuits, interacting. And so again, there's so many overlapping networks in the brain. Like one thing that definitely gets affected more in the psychiatric conditions is the reality testing is involved. The ability to tell if something is real or not, whereas neurologically that may be intact. So they know that this is something that's not, that's not real.
And that's one of the first things I'll do to see if somebody is actively hallucinating. If there's like bizarre behavior, I might do some tests to see if they are able to figure out or, distinguish between reality and a hallucination.
Yeah.
Because I want to see if somebody's actively having an experience.
Yeah, exactly. But here we're talking about non-pathological, meaning it's not schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. It's not anything like that. They don't have any other signs or symptoms of that. But they're just, they have a heightened ability to have auditory hallucinations and to have a very, very high absorption. And they have all the, these spiritualist paranormal beliefs. So it's all tied together. It's very interesting. And I wonder... there's a lot of literature on this, although not as much as we would need to answer all these questions, but like how much of the overall paranormal phenomenon in our society is driven by these 4% of people who
most
are at the extreme end of the phantasm personality spectrum.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. Are they the influencers?
Yes, exactly. Subjectively.
The influencers.
I wouldn't use that word, but that works too.
Steve, I think the answer is probably most of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's what Bob said immediately.
Yeah.
I'm interested from a neurological perspective. I know this might be like a random question, but obviously it's complicated. The picture in the mind of somebody who's schizophrenic versus somebody who is having a neurological hallucination. But let's put all of that aside. And let's say these people who are within, they're non-pathological, but they're within the extreme end, I guess we could say, of fantasy. And especially the absorption thing is what triggered this question. I wonder how active these people's default mode network is.
Yeah.
So the default mode network is a pathway in the brain that a lot of the research on it recently is in meditation research. So the idea is that if you can really focus your attention, you can quiet your DMN, because the DMN is implicated in mind wandering. It's implicated in daydreaming. And so if these people have super hyperactive default mode networks, I could see them really having that absorption problem to the extent that they can't hear somebody snapping in front of their face.
Wow.
That would be an interesting study to look at these subjects and see how they compare to, just random people off the street.
Because
it's a pretty new area of research, I think.
Yeah.
I think the DMN was only really established as a functional pathway like a few decades ago.
Definitely a burgeoning area of research that needs a lot more work. One question I had was, I wonder, and then this may be out there, but I couldn't find anything immediately, what is the correlation with intuitive versus analytical thinking style? So we know that correlates with conspiracy thinking, which I wonder how that interacts with fantasy-prone personality too. I wonder, is it like intuitive thinking style and conspiracy thinking and fantasy proneness, are those things all wrapped up together? That would not surprise me.
Yeah, that would be fascinating. I think I told you guys, a quick aside, that when I was working for Al Jazeera, I did a show called Techno. And one of the stories that we did is I went to BYU and I was a study subject in this study that they were doing on brain reactions within the Mormon population to evocative stimuli. So they would be looking at really meaningful texts or images of people within the Mormon church that really brought up a sense of spirituality in most people. Like they would have emotive reactions to it. And they were like, ooh, it'd be cool. They were like, you'll be like a normal, but we can't actually put you in the quote normals category because you have a history of being Mormon. So they were like, I wonder what'll happen. Maybe it'll evoke something because of your memories. And when they showed me my brain next to the brain of one of their typical Mormon study subjects, and they were like, see all these areas, you know, where there's all this kind of like emotional processing and all. And then they were like, and my brain was like quiet. And they pointed to one area and I was like, what's going on here? And they were like, so this is like just some analytic thought. They're like, that's how we're reading this. Like, this is all like there was no emotional activity happening at all in my brain.
What
like
does that
I was
mean,
only
though?
Thinking.
Are you okay?
And no, I mean, I think it shows exactly what Steve was talking about, that there could be this really distinct difference between people who are more identify as more intuitive and people who are more analytical. Like I'm looking at evidence, I'm thinking about it, I'm planning, I'm processing, as opposed to people who are like, I'm feeling based on this evidence. Mm-hmm. And I'm making determinations based on some more like limbic reaction, some deeper kind of like meaning and emotive reactions. I don't know. It'd be fascinating. You're right. Yeah. That'd be a cool study.
Yeah, definitely something I've been following over the years. I hadn't looked at it in a while, so it was good to do a deep dive on it again, but something I'll want to keep track of. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, KiwiCo.
KiwiCo creates super cool hands-on projects designed to expose kids of all ages to concepts in STEM. Science, technology, engineering. Oh, and let's add that some art in there and also math. Their mission is to help kids build confidence, creativity, and critical thinking skills. You know we love that. And have a really awesome experience while doing it. And each crate is designed by experts and tested by kids. And I love the fact that they are kid friendly, of course. They come with detailed instructions and you can get a crate for any child. Literally, there are age ranges that are just right for kids of all ages, even adults. I love KiwiCo. I do their crates too.
This is really doing a series of experiments. For example, you can produce an oxidation reaction and it'll eat up aluminum foil right before your eyes. And you could test the a voltmeter to learn about electric potential, as an example, or build a coin battery powered by LED light.
With KiwiCo's hands-on art and science projects, kids can engineer a walking robot, design a paint pendulum, conduct bubbling chemistry experiments, and so much more. Everything you need to make science, technology, engineering, arts, and math seriously fun, delivered to your doorstep. Get 30% off your first month, plus free shipping on any crate line with code SKEPTICS. That's 30% off your first month at KIWICO.com, promo code SKEPTICS.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. Any guesses?
And someone's having fun.
It's an animal. I'm going to guess it's a mammal.
Right.
I'm going to guess it's a big mammal.
Yep.
Yes.
Is it a semi-aquatic big mammal?
You got there except for the last one. So let's continue.
All right.
Ricard Falkvist. Q-V-I-S-T is like a kv, right? Kvist?
No
sure.
Idea.
Like knock first.
So no. Richard says, hi, thanks for the great show. This is my first guess, and I'm convinced this is a walrus. I thought that was so funny that you said aquatic, Steve. No, it's not a walrus, but yeah, it has that, but kind of like a fat animal sound to it.
Yeah.
Can you call animals fat without it being wrong?
Yeah, I think so.
So, Shane,
blubberific. It's called blubberific when you're referring to it.
Blubberific.
Oh, no.
Shane Hillier wrote it and said, hey, Jay, I'm pretty sure that's an ostrich. Love you guys.
Oh, bird.
Yeah, you know, and then again, you know, I've been doing this so long. It has a little bit of a bird thing in there. I mean, that wouldn't have been my first guess, but it's not an ostrich. Here's another guess by a regular guesser, iPuppy. He said, Jay, it's probably something more obscure than this, but I'm guessing it's a turkey. Hmm. My dad raised turkeys as a kid and used to imitate their gobble, and it sounded like that. So wait a second.
No, that's not a turkey gobble.
But his dad used to imitate turkeys, and he sounded like this week's Who's That Noisy, which doesn't mean it actually sounds like turkeys.
Jay, I want that. I want you to periodically do some Who's That Noisies that are just like, it's just the stapler on my desk. It's just a turkey.
I always want there to be something a little bit deeper than the obvious, you know?
Of course, it's too easy.
Yeah. And believe me, Kara, like, people are getting good, man. I get a lot of guesses on certain things. You know, if I straight up put a turkey out there, I'd get like 1,000 guesses.
So you're titrating the difficulty to how many emails you want to get.
It's smart. It's a good strategy.
It makes sense. I mean, I can't just put like Bob letting gas go. Everybody knows what that sounds like. Everyone will guess.
Everybody.
So guess what? Guess who's back on my radar this week? Visto Tutti. He writes in, he goes, after I stopped laughing, I played back to analyze. Good. Thank you for appreciating the humor, because I laughed my butt off when I heard this. So he says, a human says what sounds like Hindi, a Noan Gandu, which translates loosely like what a jackass. And after the hilarious trilling sound, the animal rumbles like it's large. I am saying it's an elephant. And he's correct. We won this week. So Visto, you won. Good for you. So this was sent in. The original sound was sent in by a listener named Jaron Van. I can't pronounce the rest of it. He knows who
he is. So it was
the
Hindi. The Hindi gave it away.
I think yeah, that was definitely a huge clue, because, you know, once you get there, you're thinking, like, what are large land mammals at that point? He said, I found something today on Reddit that I believe qualifies for Who's That Noisy. He gave me two different sound files. One was shorter. The other one was longer. It was really funny. And he said, I didn't know that elephants can make that Jurassic Park sound, which I thought was really funny. So then he says, it seems to be some family from Thailand that owns the elephant, and they believe that it's probably not a very – it's a very animal-friendly situation. Bottom line is, I watched the video, and the guy is just laughing, and he's playing with the elephant. He's running around. The elephant's kind of running after him, like, you know, like a dog almost, you know, just having
fun. Right, but elephants aren't dogs.
I know, but look, there are people that own them and play with them.
But dogs. It's not okay. I have a very firm stance on this.
Yeah, I know. I hear you, because they're incredibly dangerous, you know. Like,
yeah, but the sound is funny, Kara.
The sound is funny, but trust me, that elephant is not in a good way if it's like living at somebody's house.
No, it's not. Yeah. It's totally outside. It's outside. It's in a really nice
environment.
No, but
I mean, if it's owned by a family, elephants are not to be owned.
Yeah, I hear you.
They're wild animals.
Yeah, they are.
Anyway, sorry.
But here it is again. So you can enjoy it. Look, Kara, I know what you said is true, but that elephant is having a blast.
And then comes the email of being like, have you ever heard an elephant distress signal?
Yeah, right. Of course. I don't know.
Yes.
Look, no, I'm intuitively reading an elephant's core emotion here just by the sound,
like a trilling.
I know that's I can weird. Read animal emotions, and,
you know, animal, like, I'm an expert because I want to be.
God, I love it. All right, I got a new noisy for this week. Thanks everyone for writing in. I always love your emails, by the way. I don't want to dissuade you from writing me in. This email was sent in by a listener named Paul Allison, and here it is. So I want you to please guess what created that sound. That's pretty much the name of the game here. If you heard something cool this week, or you want to, you know, say, hey, Jay, how you doing? Or you want to submit an answer, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Jay, on February 20th, that's Saturday, February 20th, what did we decide, 6 p.m.? We're going to have the first Boomer versus Zoomer game show, an Woo-hoo! Online game show, where we pit generations after each other, Boomer versus Millennial versus Generation Z versus Gen Z, Gen X.
Boomer, Gen X.
And Millennial.
Gen Z, yeah. Millennial, yeah.
Who gets to name this stuff?
Society.
It's a generational game show where we pit people of different generations against each other in a trivia contest. That's basically the summary. So we're going to be doing our final test this weekend, and then we are going to do a live show. All the details will be on the website. We'll also tell you next week. You can go to our website and just find a link if you want to register. And that's it. George Traub is the host, and me, Steve, and Brian Wecht are the quiz masters.
Quizmasters.
Three people will be selected as audience members, and you can sign up yourself.
Don't forget to save the date. August 6th and 7th is the next Digital Nexus. It's going to be awesome. You could go to necss.org to register, and we will be putting any updated information there as we start booking guests, etc. This is just the first, you know, the early just save the date kind of notice. All right, we have a Name That Logical Fallacy this week. This is an email that we got from Guerrick from Vancouver. And Guerrick writes, I've often observed that when asked to provide examples or suggestions matching certain criteria, people will often substitute a different kind of question and answer that instead. For example, a request for best spaceships in sci-fi will often result in a lot of answers that seem to instead respond to an unasked question like a spaceship from the best sci-fi that happens to include spaceships. I've seen this sort of thing happen often in discussions of media, cooking recipes, book recommendations, and more. Is this just a specific form of the availability heuristic, or is there something more complex happening where people either don't understand or don't respond to specificity of questions in certain contexts? Guerrick, that's a very interesting question. This is the first thing that came to mind because I've noticed this myself with the Oscars and similar awards. Have you guys ever noticed this? Where, like, somebody wins the Oscar for best editing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's one, and the best editing nominees are from all the best movies of the year.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And I'm like, all right, did those movies have the best editing, or are those just the best movies? Like the editing in the best movies.
Yeah,
you know what
so
I mean?
It's within that smaller sample that we're
exactly.
even bothering.
Yeah, like exactly. I assume that if it's loved so much, it had to have great editing.
And it also had to have great art direction and great makeup and great costumes.
Can't a crappy or B-level movie or a movie that's good but just not Oscar level in terms of the actors in the movie, but just have like fantastic art direction or really good costuming. But it always seems to be coming from this very small, you know, group of top tier movies. And I always thought that that was a bias, exactly
sure.
what he's saying. I think that his suggestion that it's the availability heuristic is a partial explanation, and that the availability heuristic is just that it's a couple of things. When we think of examples of something, you know, we think of the examples that come to mind that are available to us, but also it's the assumption that if I can think of an example, that something is more likely, it's more common, right? So like, how often does this happen? If I could think of an example where it did happen, I overestimate, or I think it happens very often, which is not strictly true.
Mm.
But in any case, I do think that's part of it. I also do think it's substitution, because we're just substituting in a criterion that is easier, right? So it's kind of a marker or a stand-in. You know, it's like, I don't really know what the best art direction is, but I like this movie, you know, so I'm going to nominate the art direction in this movie, which was good for other reasons. Can you guys think of other examples where that sort of thing happens?
I mean, this is a hard one, because I think some of it has to do with just limited exposure, right? It is the availability heuristic. Like, how do I consider other things if I don't know that they exist?
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I was confused a little bit by the email that came in, you know, asking it. Really, it was just a question of like, which logical fallacy is this? But it was hard for me to come up with other examples, because I didn't even really understand what was the example that he used again.
So in other words, if you ask somebody what's the best spaceship in science fiction, and they tell you a spaceship from a good science fiction show, like, oh, like the Enterprise. Did you say the Enterprise because Star Trek is your favorite science fiction, or is that really the best ship?
Right.
Or is there some obscure, crappy science fiction that happens to have an awesome spaceship in it? Right. So it's the same kind of thing as the Oscars. So he's saying, what is it? What's the major malfunction that's happening when people ask a question that's different than the one I actually asked? And I do think they're substituting an easier, more available question. I think that's...
Yeah.
And so it is a little bit of intellectual laziness.
I also think it's kind of like an issue of, and I don't know what we would call this, but just an issue of like a lack of expertise in an area. So I definitely think if you were to say, what sci-fi has the best spaceship? to a group of like massive sci-fi nerds, there would be this big argument that opens up and people would start bringing in obscure examples. Yeah. But if you say it to most people, they're going to be like the Enterprise or, you know,
Millennium Falcon,
TIE Fighter, you know, something like that.
TIE Fighter? Are you on crack, Kara?
I don't know.
No, I do think that, all right, to broaden this a little bit, I have experienced myself and other people, it's always obvious when more obvious when other people do it, of course, where you get asked a question, of course, like, you know, in any kind of scholarly, academic, educational environment, Kara, you must see this a lot. Like, I ask a student a question, they answer a question they can answer that's closest to the one that I asked them, even if it's not precisely the question that I asked them.
Oh, and that's a brilliant strategy.
It's a good technique.
By the way, I use that all the time in interviews.
It works.
Right? Yeah. You was like, I don't normally answer that question, but here's something that sort of sounds like it. I'm going to answer that one. And sometimes,
and it usually works because you distract the interviewer from their original question.
I mean, it may work in an interview. It does not work when a physician is asking a medical student the question, because it's the gulf is too big, because it's just really obvious what they're doing. And also, it doesn't help, because what you're really saying is, I didn't understand your question, and that's more important than knowing the
answer.
You're
right, yeah. It's very different than if you have two people, like, on air having a conversation, and somebody says, answer me this, and they go, well, blah, 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 in a different way, because it keeps the flow going, and the audience usually doesn't notice. But if somebody goes,
You ever see a politician interviewed when you see a politician interviewed one-on-one on a Sunday morning show or whatever, that politician is coming in knowing exactly what they want to say. They don't really care what the hell the question
is. Yeah, but they're not even
they're
like...
They're going to say what they want to say.
They're not even trying. That's
deliberate.
They're
not skillful about it.
No, even when they are skillful, that's deliberate.
It's totally deliberate.
Oh, yeah.
They just pivot to their talking point, because that's a strategy.
But they usually make left turns. You got to be like, you got to be like suave about answering the question you want to answer, not the question you were asked.
But getting the interview, though, I've been on both sides of that too on an interview. And you're right, Kara. Like, if you get asked a question, sometimes like the question is not that relevant, or it's not that precise. And I will sort of morph it into a question I can answer that's interesting. And that's okay for an interview, because it's all about the conversation, and how you got there is not that important. But it's different. Like, if you're in a court of law and you try that doesn't work, obviously. A good lawyer will redirect you to the precise question that they're asking and not let you wiggle out of it.
Right,
so context is critical in terms of this phenomenon.
Absolutely. You're so right. And I mean, in real life, I wonder how much of that is the pressure that we often face. And this is a very Western, especially a very American pressure, that most people are not comfortable saying, I don't know.
Yeah, that's part of it.
Right.
I agree.
Yeah.
It's okay to say, I don't know. And I would say that the skeptical lesson here is, if the question's important, obviously it's like this best spaceship in sci-fi, who cares? Let's talk about the thing I want to talk about, right? That's fine. You know, when you are having a meaningful discussion about a scientific topic, a skeptical topic, or whatever, think about what the other person's actually saying. And, you know, beyond just asking you a question. And this is one of my biggest complaints when I get into discussions with people that I disagree with, is they're not responding to what I'm actually saying. They're responding to the point that they want to respond to, even if they have to shoehorn or strawman me into that point, because that's their talking point. And it's like, that's not what I'm saying. Listen to what I'm actually saying. Don't infer a point you want to talk about, because you get nowhere when you do that. Now you're just you're trolling. You're pontificating about what you want to pontificate about, rather than actually engaging with the other person. So don't be that person. Stop. Think about what they're actually saying. Steel man them, right? Don't straw man them. Try to address the best best version of their argument, not the worst version of it, and also adhere to the principle of charity. So I think in a meaningful context, that's kind of a similar thing, where you're substituting what you want to talk about rather than what the actual question is. Okay, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. So you guys have been doing really well so far this year, which means I need to up the game. So we'll see if I did that this week. I don't know. It's hard. It's getting really hard to predict how you guys are going to respond to these. All right, here we go. Three regular news items. Item number one, a new study finds that some coronaviruses can steal genes from an organism they infect in order to learn how to evade their immune system. Whoa. Item number two, scientists calculate that a tiny crustacean, the amphipod Dulichiella appendiculata, has the fastest moving body part of any animal, a claw that can close 10,000 times faster than the blink of an eye, averaging 93 microseconds. And item number three, a new analysis of the star Betelgeuse finds that it is about 25% closer to Earth than previously thought, 530 light years instead of the previous estimate of 724. There they are. Evan, go first.
Coronavirus stealing genes from an organism to learn how to evade their immune system. Oh boy, can viruses do this? Where have we seen this before? Is this, have other viruses done this? Do we have evidence of this? I've not heard of this before. So this is fascinating. We are learning all sorts of new stuff about coronavirus. It's probably the most studied virus these days, I would think. That one's weird. Next one, crustacean. It's tiny. Can close its claw 10,000 times faster than the blink of an eye. Oh my gosh. Was that 93 microseconds? That's fast. The fact that we can even calculate that, if this one's true, is amazing in itself, let alone the fact that it might be happening. So that's remarkable. So remarkable, it's probably science. Too cool to not be science, as I think Perry used to say. And the last one, Betelgeuse, 25% closer to Earth than previously thought. Whoa, what? That's a lot. Oh my gosh. Why would that be the case, though? How could we have been so far off? If we're so far off in Betelgeuse, how many other star measurements kind of had to be maybe recalculated as a result? Oh, it's either the Betelgeuse or the coronavirus one. Dang. I think it is the Betelgeuse one. I don't think we would have it that wrong. 25% closer to Earth than previously thought. That's a huge, huge, huge discrepancy, astronomically speaking. So I think that one's the fiction.
Okay, Kara.
I'm tempted to go with Evan. I think that, you know, it would not surprise me if coronaviruses can take gene sequences from their host and utilize those to help. I mean, that part's cool, that they can utilize those gene sequences to actually help evade the immune response. But all viruses swap all the time, so I wouldn't be surprised by that. The amphipod, so a tiny crustacean. I want to see this little guy, and he's got tiny little claws. It depends, I guess, if he's really tiny. And you go snip, snip, snip. I don't know what he's snapping them at. Why would a tiny crustacean need tiny little claws? I don't know. I mean, 10,000 times
big claws.
Right? That's true. that wouldn't be helpful. But what do claws do? Don't they, like, they break through food, or they hold on to that? What is the function of a claw? And why does this little guy have one? I mean, I could see it being faster than the blink of an eye. Eyes are big, especially compared to a tiny crustacean claw. But then Betelgeuse being 25% closer to the Earth, I'm going to use some Bob reasoning here and be like, I would have heard about that. You know what I mean? Like 25% closer? That's big. It's
okay.
A lot closer. So I'm going to go with, Evan.
Jay?
Like, making these astronomical calculations, I always wonder like how precise they can get. 25% sounds an awful lot like there was a massive miscalculation. That's interesting. I mean, I would imagine that there's so many factors involved that they're probably adjusting these numbers all the time. It's just that 25% sounds like a big number, but maybe maybe this type of recalculation happens quite a bit. I don't know. The second one about the tiny crustacean has the fastest moving body part, a claw that can close 10,000, blink of an eye. Wow. 10,000 times faster than the blink of an eye. It's probably so small that it just has to move a tiny little bit. And I agree with Kara, like, you know, what's this guy doing that he needs to be whipping around like that? And going to the first one, the coronavirus steals genes from an organism. I mean, I just don't – this is the one where I am so much reading about coronavirus that, I mean, unless this dropped today, I would imagine I would have read this because I'm reading science news a lot. I'm going to take a stab in the dark here and say the coronavirus one is a fake.
And Bob?
The coronavirus, I wouldn't be surprised. can't remember specifically hearing that they take, they could steal genes. I thought a lot of it was just like random mutations. But yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. The crustacean surprised me. I always thought it was that other creature that was the fastest. Remember that one? It was a beautifully colorful creature. Is it? I think it's a crustacean as well. I wonder if it's related.
It's a little lobster punch, right? The bullet punch, the bullet lobster or something?
No, it's not that. Not the bullet lobster. Yeah, but that's, yeah. That's
talking about like that little disco shrimp looking guy?
Yeah, the screaming shrimp.
I thought that was the fastest. And that wasn't a snipper. It was like a puncher. And the cool thing was that it punched so fast that it would actually pull like energy out of the water. I mean, it was so fast. And it would fry its victims. So this one, 90.
The mantis shrimp.
Yes, mantis shrimp. I love mantis shrimp. They are fascinating. Now, 100,000 times faster than the blink of an eye. So a blink of an eye is about a tenth of a second. So we're about, that's 100,000th of a second. That's fast. But yeah, I mean, sounds reasonable. What doesn't sound reasonable is Betelgeuse being 25% closer. That's huge. Way too big. I'd be shocked if they were off for that by that much for this long. And for that reason alone, I'm going to say that's fiction.
All right, so most of you think that Betelgeuse is a fiction. Jay is by his lonesome with the coronavirus stealing genes, but you all agree on number two, so we'll start there. Scientists calculate that a tiny crustacean, the amphipod Dulichiella appendiculata, has the fastest moving body part of any animal, a claw that can close 10,000 times faster than the blink of an eye, averaging 93 microseconds. You guys all think that one is science, and this one is the fiction.
What?
Oh, no.
Boom,
no,
baby.
Oh, no. Wait. You got what?
Us. Jesus.
There's one part of that. Coronavirus. One part of that that what? Is the fiction, and that is it's not the fastest moving body part of any animal. And the thing that you could have figured out there was that the mantis shrimp is also one of these creatures that has an extremely fast moving body part. But mantis shrimp and the amphipod are in water. And mm-hmm. the water prevents them from having the fastest moving body part. Yeah.
Boo.
So the one that there's two creatures that I've seen referenced that are very similar to each other. They're ants. So they're in air, right? So one is called the trapjaw ant, Odontomachus. And the other one is another kind of ant, the Dracula ant.
Cool name.
So their jaws, you know, their mandibles snap closed. And they're a little bit faster. So because they have air instead of water as resisting. So why does this tiny little shrimp, it's a cute guy, it's as big as they say, it's as big as a sunflower seed. So that's tiny.
Oh my God.
Only the males have one giant claw. The other claw is not big. So the males have one giant claw, which suggests it might be, you know, sexual selection.
Sexual.
Or some kind of sexual competition there. But they, when they snap it closed, it causes cavitation. So it causes like a bubble in the water.
That's what mantis shrimp does too.
Yeah, so mantis shrimp does as well. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a very cool little guy. And all those other facts though were correct. It just isn't the fastest. Wow. All right, let's go back to number one. A new study finds that some coronaviruses conceal genes from an organism they infect in order to learn how to evade their immune system. That is science. This is a little concerning. This is not SARS-CoV-2. It's other types of coronaviruses, ones that do not so far infect people. But this is a ability that these viruses are acquiring, which is not a good thing, right? And so what they do is they decrease the inflammatory reaction in the host, and that causes the infection to become chronic.
Ooh.
And that's not a good thing. So right now, This particular form of the virus has been found in the hedgehog. It's a hedgehog coronavirus. Interesting. Hopefully the human coronavirus doesn't acquire that skill.
Yeah.
And let's move on to number three. A new analysis of the star Betelgeuse finds that it is about 25% closer to Earth than previously thought, 530 light years instead of the previous estimate of 724.
Man.
Yeah, what the hell, man? That is science. They learned a lot of new things about Betelgeuse. They've been studying it very closely, the researchers who published this study. This is the Kavli Institute for the Physics and Mathematics of the Universe. So Betelgeuse is a giant, red giant star. It's the left shoulder of Orion, if you're wondering. And remember we were talking recently about, is it going to go supernova?
Yeah.
Right.
You can see it in the Southern Hemisphere, Bob. We saw it in the Southern Hemisphere. It's just upside down.
Yeah. So cool.
Yeah, it's in that part of the sky that rotates around, so you get to see it in both hemispheres. So Betelgeuse was dimming. And because it's in the red giant phase, it could be going supernova any day now. That was the thinking. But it turns out that the dimming is almost certainly due to a dust cloud and not an intrinsic decrease in the brightness of the star.
That's lame.
So it's extrinsic?
It's extrinsic. It's a dust cloud outside the star. So they also found that they concluded that Betelgeuse is probably in the helium burning phase, and therefore it probably has 100,000 years to go before it goes supernova. So it's not going to go supernova anytime soon. Yeah, probably only a mere 100,000 years, but still long after we're gone. And they also revised their estimate of its size based upon this analysis. And that change in size, it's only 2/3 as big as we thought it was.
What? This is disappointing.
It's smaller and closer than we thought, not bigger and farther away.
Oh, wow.
So it was revised to be only 530 light years away. The previous estimate was 724 light years. 25% closer, a little bit
actually. What technique did they use to determine its distance?
They used a bunch of techniques. So
yeah, they all failed?
So they were talking about the fact, so they used evolutionary hydrodynamic and seismic modeling. That was sort of the primary analysis that they did.
Yeah, but that's not going to tell you distance.
Because it told them the size. And then they also found, they studied the stellar pulsations to figure out how big the day was. So a lot of details. They really did a deep dive on Betelgeuse. So, and then I was reading, along these lines, they were saying that, a lot of our estimates of how far away stars are just that, they're estimates. And even a lot of,
the farther away, the more downhill, right?
Even for some relatively close stars, it could be very difficult to precisely tell their distance. So if you have a standard candle, that could tell you the distance, for example, to a globular cluster, and then we pretty much know how far away all of the stars in that globular cluster are.
Right, because they're all roughly the same
distance away. Yes, we only need one of those stars to be a Cepheid variable or something where we could tell its absolute brightness, and therefore we can tell its from its relative brightness exactly how far away it is. But for others, for really close stars, we can use parallax. But, 530 light years is actually getting a little far away for parallax. And so, its distance was really an estimate based upon what we know about the star. So a lot of those estimates are based upon being in the main sequence. And we just know from the light characteristics of the star, we were estimating its relative brightness, its absolute brightness, and therefore, by its apparent brightness, we can estimate its distance. But, Betelgeuse is at the end of one end of the spectrum there, and we didn't understand it as well as we thought we did. And so improving our knowledge of, again, like the stellar evolution of Betelgeuse was allowed them to re-estimate its size and therefore its distance. Yeah, I was surprised.
This is like learning that Pluto was a dwarf planet.
Yeah.
The same feeling of disappointment.
How far does parallax take us? I forget what that number is.
I think like the absolute limit is like 1,000 light years, but something like that. But that gets very, very difficult when you get beyond even like the first 100 or so, I think, light years. You need increasingly precise measurements of the parallax.
My image of Betelgeuse is forever shattered.
So
yeah, it was it was a giant star.
Now it's still a giant star.
Of all the stars you could kind of just name off the top of your head, Betelgeuse had to be in like the top three.
So it's 750 times the radius of the sun. That's how big it is. But they thought it was even bigger than that.
That's still huge.
They thought it was so big that it would, the previous estimate of its size was that it would go out to the orbit of Jupiter. That's how, can you imagine?
Wow.
Now it only goes out to like the orbit of Mars or something like that. Okay, cool. Evan, give us the quote.
You suck, Steve.
Here is the quote. It was a good one.
Hey, I was due.
You said you were going to make this harder, and you delivered.
I did.
Well done.
Ooh.
Well, here's a quote to cheer us all up. We have to be prepared always for the possibility that each new discovery, no matter what science furnishes it, may modify the conclusions we draw. Alfred Wegener, from his book The Origin of Continents and Oceans. Now, Alfred is most remembered as the originator of the continental drift hypothesis. In 1912, he suggested that the continents are slowly drifting around the Earth, and his hypothesis was controversial, widely rejected until the 1950s.
Did you guys see this animation? I can't remember how I came across it recently. It's a billion years and 40 seconds, where it basically shows you the movement of all the continents.
Yeah, obviously, it was on New York Times.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah,
yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah, very, very cool. It always seems a little weird to me. Have you had this experience? Because it seems like random movements, and then they settle into place where they're supposed to be, which is the current you know, location. But it's such a bias, you know?
Yeah, it's hindsight for sure.
I like it if it looks like this. Yeah.
Okay. But it's the same feeling as like watching a video of something being destroyed backwards, because it's coming together, you know? But the together is completely just our bias about what they're supposed to look like, the continents.
Yeah. Sure. And in our brains, we're like, wrong, 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 right.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. Very cool. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You got it, man.
Thank you, Steve.
Sure.
Thanks, Steve.
We will see you all on the Friday live stream. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.